Interest rates and tax policy, two vital components of our economic landscape, often interact in fascinating ways. They influence the behavior of individuals, businesses, and governments. But how? In this episode, we engage in a thoughtful discussion with Alan Cole, senior economist at the Tax Foundation. We explore how changes in interest rates can affect everything from deficits and tax revenues to investment decisions and the overall economy. Hello, and welcome to The Deduction, a podcast from the Tax Foundation. I'm your host, Kyle Woolahan, and today we are joined by senior economist Alan Cole. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kyle. Good to be here.
So before we dive into the world of interest rates, I wanted to get to know you a little better, Alan. I was curious about what got you started in tax policy. What interests you? Where did this begin for you?
For me, a lot of it is just enjoying math and economics in general, but then also thinking really specifically about how taxes didn't always treat the time value of money appropriately. So almost this exact topic, like what happens when a dollar today is worth different from a dollar tomorrow, and how should income on investments, on savings, things like that be taxed. I got really interested in that. And then I met some Tax Foundation economists while I was working on the Hill, and I got in touch.
It's always interesting because I think we think of money as such a such an unchanging thing, like money is money, but it's not, which I think is what you're talking about, what we're going to be talking about today with interest rates and how that affects the economy, how it affects our spending and that time value of money. But that's all very fascinating. And I think we have the perfect expert to discuss all of this stuff today. And I always enjoy getting to just learn more about my coworkers and hearing what you guys are up to. But let's get into it. So we've all seen in the news and, you know, have felt the effects on our wallets. But what does the Federal Reserve setting interest rates really mean?
Well, the Federal Reserve's interest rates are largely about keeping a balance of money and stuff in the economy relatively equal. And I can give you some examples of what I mean by that. Sometimes you feel like there's too much money chasing too few goods, too little stuff. And that's kind of how we feel like we are now. We can talk about this in the technical economist's way, but I think it's better to just acknowledge what you're seeing on the ground as a participant in the economy. Lately, even if you have money to spend, it feels like it's kind of hard to get the goods and services that you want without problems like delays or shortages or rising prices. That's a problem of too much money in the economy for our productive capacity. That's one style of problem that the Federal Reserve can deal with. But if you rewind the clock back to, say, 2009, you can almost see the exact reverse style of problem. If you had money in your pocket back then, you were in great shape. You could easily find people to hire. But the problem was getting money. If you wanted to sell things to get money, it was really difficult. Most likely, you might be selling your labor and trying to find a job in a bad job market. But you also might have had a house to sell and have struggled to sell that, or you might have struggled to make revenues on your small business. That's a problem of too little money in the economy. The Fed kind of tries to chart a course between these two outcomes because neither one of them is really desirable. Nobody liked the 2009 economy, and people had a lot of problems with the economy of the past couple of years when the inflation readings were highest. So the Fed's trying to avoid both of those and chart a course between, and they use interest rates to do that.
And so how exactly does the Fed correct that, and why are interest rates higher right now?
You can think of interest rates almost as a way of bribing people not to spend now. it's a little bit odd that the government sets them. It's not quite something you'd expect, but it's a side effect or a natural obligation that they have when they're also controlling the currency. Control of the currency effectively means that you have to make some decisions about how much currency gets released into the economy in order to keep this balance of money and stuff relatively in balance. And we use interest rates when they're high. We're kind of telling people, if you hold off on spending now, you'll be allowed to have more money later, perhaps when inflationary pressures are lower. We're also a little bit signaling to the government that, hey, deficit reduction would be pretty good right now, because you're losing money paying out interest to people. And then in the reverse case, if you think that there's not enough spending in the economy, there's too little money chasing goods, then one thing you can do is set interest rates much lower. And that's what we did, for example, in 2009, when we had too little money chasing the economy's productive capacity. And with low interest rates, it's kind of the opposite. It says, well, you can borrow money, and if you have any idea for spending now, we'll give you a low interest rate to do it. And hopefully that encourages some spending. One that a lot of consumers might be familiar with is a car loan. In the not so distant past, there were times when you could get, as low as 0.9% APR. Essentially, you can bring your money forward in time, spend on a car right now, and just pay it back later without too much trouble. Car loans are much higher. That's kind of because other interest rates in the economy follow the Federal Reserve. And this is exactly what they want. They don't really want people borrowing more money to throw more money at cars, because consumers are finding that cars especially actually have gotten really expensive, that there's a lot of money chasing a limited productive capacity. Some of that's because of pandemic-related problems, but some of that's just because there was a lot of money in the economy in general, especially after pandemic relief bills and after the Federal Reserve had low interest rates for a while to stimulate the economy during the COVID-19 crisis. But now we found that's too much, and we're trying to kind of curb some of that spending. And you can see how high interest rates are a mechanism for doing that, if you think about it in terms of say, car loans and car payments.
So if I've got this correct, it seems like the Fed's role is at times, either maybe they think the economy is growing too quickly or going too fast or going too far, and there's not enough happening. And then sometimes there isn't a lot of economic activity happening, and they're trying to incentivize it. Is that correct? Am I on track?
Yeah, we refer to these as kind of too hot or too cold. And too hot is when there's a lot of money looking around for stuff to buy, but the stuff to buy is a little bit in short supply. And too cold means the opposite. It means that a lot of people have talents to sell or stuff to sell, but there just doesn't seem to be enough kind of consumer capacity to pay for those products. And it's important to note that hot is sort of good to some degree. You do want everyone to be employed. You do want everyone to be earning money, but it can get to excess. As it did in the past couple of years, you've got whenever people earn more money, it seems like that just goes immediately into the rising price of goods. And so it's not like you benefit from a hot economy after a certain point.
That makes a lot of sense. And so, Alan, I mean, we are the Tax Foundation after all. So I've got to understand, and I think our listeners are wondering, what how do interest rates affect taxes, and what's the role there?
Well, tax policymakers, I think, should be aware of interest rates, and higher interest rates kind of mean some things for tax policymakers, and lower interest rates would mean different things. The first is obviously that there's a higher cost of borrowing for the government, and that means the deficit reduction is a especially good idea at the moment. So now's a good time to think about cutting spending if you're on the spending side, or also if you're on the tax side, you might be thinking about eliminating the least useful tax breaks or raising the least harmful taxes. Those are better ideas than they would be under a less inflationary, lower interest rate circumstance. And it's also worth mentioning that deficit reduction kind of helps solve the problem. It's not just a response to the problem, it also helps solve it, because deficit reduction effectively takes money out of the economy. The easiest example of this is, you know, if the government taxes me more, then I have less money to spend on stuff, and the balance of money and stuff kind of gets restored a little bit closer to equal. For example, if I lost $1,000 to taxes, then that would be 1,000 fewer dollars out there in the world chasing goods and bidding up their prices. So deficit reduction can help with the problem. It's not just the government's response to insulate itself from the problem. And you can even see that Congress has pivoted on this somewhat. You can see that, say, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia has become very assertive on deficit reduction and inflation reduction in 2022 and 2023. He's been kind of a key swing vote in the Senate. And while he was on board for some deficit increasing bills in the early 2020s, he's now pivoted, as well as some of other members of Congress, towards at least aspiring towards deficit reduction. And you can even see that in the name of the Inflation Reduction Act, which at least aspired to pay for itself. So there's been a change in fiscal policy because of interest rates, and I think that's a good thing.
Do state governments also need to consider deficit reduction?
Yeah, it's also a good time for state governments to respond to higher interest rates. They don't have quite the same responsibilities that the federal government does in terms of containing inflation, but they have the changed incentive structure from higher interest rates, where it just becomes a lot better to get your fiscal house in order. Many states have balanced budget amendments to some degree. But there's also things like state pension funds. It's a great time to top those up and make sure that they're fully funded, because your pension fund manager is going to earn greater returns in expectation than he did in the past. For example, you can get a higher return even on government bonds, risk-free for certain, than you could in the past. So you know it's just going to be a better time to do this now than at some other time where interest rates are lower. And in a way, that's exactly what the Federal Reserve is wanting to incentivize. States are acting when they do things like fill up pension funds or contribute to their rainy day funds rather than spending their money immediately. That's kind of what the Federal Reserve is looking for, because it puts less money out there into the economy to chase after stuff right now, and instead saves some of it for later. That reduces inflationary pressure. So in their own way, if states respond appropriately to the incentive of higher interest rates, they will contribute to the fighting of inflation that the Federal Reserve is looking for.
That's very interesting, because I think a lot of times when you're thinking about interest rates and the Federal Reserve, you're really only so focused on what the federal government is doing and what's happening on this grander scale. But it really, it has this trickle down effect all the way through.
Right. And, you know, states, they can't set their own interest rates like the federal government has the ability to do. The federal government, of course, can't just set them at zero all the time because they have a responsibility to contain inflation. But states do need to be active in responding to the macroeconomic situation in their own way.
So, Alan, I think we're getting close to maybe your favorite part of this podcast, or the thing you're most interested in talking about, which is the time value of money. And so how is that? What's the relationship here with interest rates, taxes, time value of money? What, break this down for me.
Well, it's both the case that the government and taxpayers both care about timing more than they used to. There's a big question of timing in taxes, not just what rate do you pay, but when do you pay it? I think we all agree, you know, if you earn $10,000 over time and eventually spend all of that $10,000 on things for yourself, at some point you should be writing $10,000 on your tax form and your tax burden should be calculated based on that amount. But there's a big question within that period of when exactly do you pay? And if the tax code gets this wrong, it can discourage you from saving or investing. And even if it's getting it right, you know, it matters to both taxpayer and government exactly when that money is collected. To me, the best mechanism that's easiest to get right is that you should accrue tax liability when you withdraw money from savings and spend it. So that's kind of like a traditional 401k or a traditional defined benefit pension. You pay tax when you get your money out, not when you earn your accrual. That's my ideal system. But some systems have you paying tax earlier. And the difference between my ideal system and the systems where you pay tax earlier matter a lot more when the time value of money matters more, when you care more about later versus now. And that's what an interest rate is. It's a measure of how much you care about now versus later. And the higher it is, the more you care about things now versus later. An example of a system where these effects come into play. If you have an ordinary brokerage account, you pay taxes when you first earn money and put it into the account, but you also pay tax when you receive dividends or realize capital gains. That's the kind of system where you ideally would have wanted to realize that income later, but unfortunately, some of it gets taxed earlier than you'd actually like to spend your money. That's a downside, and that's a downside that can discourage people from saving.
So here at the Tax Foundation, Alan, I'm just wondering, what are some of the values, or what are some of the things that we think should go along with interest rates that would help with all of these things?
Definitely, I would move towards traditional 401k style or traditional IRA style treatment on more types of saving. That would protect taxpayers from essentially accruing a tax burden just because they waited to spend their money and got a nominal increase in how much money they earned, just by virtue of waiting. It's bad to have taxes on that component of earnings because it distorts the preference. It makes people potentially change their savings decisions just because of the taxes. And it kind of makes us a country where people focus more on spending their money now rather than saving for later. Another place where you can modify the tax code to better take into account the time value of money is with businesses and their investments. When they buy new property, plant, or equipment, or even spend on R&D because of a recent change to policy there, they don't get to deduct the full costs of that immediately. Instead, they record that expense over many years, even though the money cost of it came all up front. That's a timing mismatch between the reality of the business cash flows and the tax code. We don't like that. Let's illustrate that by way of a counterexample. Suppose you managed to match up tax liability to a business's cash flows perfectly, and you took, say, the U.S. corporate rate of 21%. There's no obvious way that the tax code would, under those circumstances, change a business's behavior. If your taxes perfectly match your cash flows, and it's like you take every number in the business's spreadsheets, reduce it by 21% to reflect the 21% rate. But all of the positive numbers are still positive, meaning all of the projects that are good remain good even after tax. And all of the negative numbers are still negative. That is, the business is still avoiding unwise decisions. By contrast, if you don't match those cash flows perfectly, like is true of the actual U.S. tax code, that creates a distortion. There's potential for a business to forego an investment that actually would have been profitable purely for tax reasons. And that's inefficient, and it makes us poorer in the longer run because you've got foregone investment. People are less productive. Maybe at low interest rates, which we've had for much of my lifetime, that's a smaller problem. These timing effects don't make as much of a difference. And then it's okay to treat a dollar tomorrow the same as a dollar today because they're worth mostly the same thing. You know, if your interest rates are 1%, well, your tax code's only 1% off. But right now at higher interest rates, the Fed has the risk-free interest rate at 5%. It's a much bigger problem.
Yeah, so if I'm understanding this correctly, what's happening is money is being pushed in, to break this down really simply, because I'm not an economist like you. Money is being pushed into different years. If I bought, you know, a $50,000 tractor today, you know, some of that money, that expense, is being pushed into different years. Is that correct?
Yeah. If you had a small business that used the tractor, presumably in agriculture, you would be able to deduct that as a legitimate business expense. Income is earnings minus or revenues minus expenses. But your deductions for that tractor would be potentially over several years rather than just in the immediate year that you spent on it. But you're actually out the money in the year that you bought the tractor. So the tax code doesn't match up with the reality of what your business is actually like, or what the cash flows from your business are like. If it matched the cash flows better, then there's no chance that you would forego a profitable investment because of taxes. But I think it does happen, at least with some fraction of investment, in our current tax code.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think it certainly is an effect for businesses, especially small businesses, that you would need to have, you know, you would need that full $50,000 now while it's still worth that same amount. But yeah, as we're sort of wrapping up here, I think the time value of money is fascinating. And I'm so grateful that you were here explaining a lot of this to us. But I am curious, as a curious person, what are some of the quirks of interest rates and how they might affect businesses or individuals or things like that?
One thing that worked really well during low interest rate periods, and accountants are very familiar with, is the idea of carrying forward losses. The idea here is if you didn't make money in a period, whether in real life or just as a result of how your taxes are calculated. You had more deductions or expenses than revenues recorded for a year. You can say, we'll hold on to that loss. We'll hold on to kind of the wasted deductions that we didn't have any revenue to match up with. And we'll use those deductions next year instead. And that works pretty well at low interest rates. It effectively means you're kind of combining 2 years into one, and you're merging the deductions you couldn't use in the first year with income you got in the second year, and canceling things out and making the calculation work. But the problem with that is it doesn't quite work as well if money next year is significantly different in value than money this year. For example, the 5% interest rates we currently have, there's a real cost to delaying your deduction. It becomes 5% less valuable. So businesses won't get as much benefit from that provision as before. One way you could potentially solve that is by saying, well, we could have businesses pay negative tax. You actually can get into loss-making behavior, and the government will send you a rebate this year. But there are reasons not to like that. The idea of the government sending out checks to businesses a little bit just feels inherently maybe abusable. It certainly doesn't accord with a lot of people's ideas of how things should work. And so while it feels like the technically right solution to the time value of money problem in some ways, I think we will almost certainly stick with the loss carry forward system that we have. And it will unfortunately just be less useful for businesses than it was before.
Well, I think the government probably doesn't want to be cutting anybody a check. I think that's pretty reasonable for all of us to assume. But yeah, I mean, carry forwards and carry backs, it's interesting. It's a confusing topic. And it's one of those things that we see here at the Tax Foundation all the time, is that there's trade-offs everywhere. Like there isn't like an exact perfect system for everything. And we have to work within this system and hopefully have, you know, transparency and simplicity, like the things that we're rooting for. But yeah, so as we, you know, really wrap this up here, Alan, I want to thank you so much for being on and explaining everything to us and the time value of money. This is a fascinating podcast, and I just want to give you a chance to plug anything you're working on or anything you're doing, social media, just give you a little bit of runway to just go for it.
Absolutely. What I'm working on next for Tax Foundation is an explanation of the Pillar 2 agreement brokered initially by the OECD, but now there's more than 140 countries involved. And that's about keeping taxes on global businesses at a kind of minimum tax rate of 15% worldwide. There are going to be a lot of problems with this. It's very hard to make any tax deal that involves multiple jurisdictions work well. And I think there's a lot of potential downside for the U.S., but that can be mitigated if we think this through carefully. We figure out how to protect U.S. tax revenues, and we figure out how to keep compliance burdens. That is kind of the cost of paying people to understand complex tax issues. We want to keep those compliance burdens to a minimum. And that's what I'll be working on over the next few months. And you'll see some upcoming publications from Tax Foundation on the topic.
That is very fascinating. And we will be sure to keep tuned. As you can see, Alan is very good at explaining all of these complex, nuanced issues. So please check out everything that he's writing. Follow him on Twitter and just keep posted on all that Alan is doing. And thank you very much, Alan.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of The Deduction. To learn more about the Tax Foundation and The Deduction, visit us at taxfoundation.org/podcast. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at Tax Foundation. If you've been enjoying our show and want to help us grow, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. It helps others find the show. And if you didn't enjoy The Deduction, well, keep it to yourself. Another way you can support our work is by donating to the Tax Foundation on our website. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time.